Y'all feel pretty comfortable and confident about managing moist soil units now, manipulating hydrology, doing mechanical manipulations. All right. Well, an obvious thing that you want to know, and your boss wants to know, and you want to show your boss, is that your management is effective. What you're doing is increasing the capability for you to sustain waterfowl in a particular, well, on your management area or your refuge. Okay? And that brings in the concept of habitat evaluation, and one of the most common ways that we evaluate habitat quality for migrating and wintering waterfowl in the south, well, in the southern latitudes, is by calculating what are called duck use days, okay, or waterfowl foraging carrying capacity. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, duck use day calculations are a standard calculation that's not only used for actually evaluating management practices, but also DUD calculations are made for every single WMA that, in the state of Tennessee, as well as other states, okay, and on federal refuges, and that information is actually used to see whether or not we can currently sustain the existing population of North American waterfowl migrating through these different areas. And this is all underneath of what is called one of the greatest conservation plans ever. It's called the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. So we're going to start off and talk about really where did duck use days, where was it conceived from, and why was it conceived, and how it's used as really on a national scale, how it's used to evaluate whether or not we can sustain our current populations of waterfowl. Okay, so we'll start off with that. We'll talk about the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. We'll talk specifically about what is a duck use day, and how do we basically estimate duck use days? What are some different techniques? And then we are still attempting to come up with techniques that managers can use, biologists can use, that are user-friendly, that provide good information for getting accurate estimates of duck use days. Okay, and so we'll talk about some research directions and needs. All right, any questions? All right. So, this is a picture of, through a lot of data over the years of band returns and personal observations of the migratory flyways of waterfowl. And you can kind of see that they're concentrated coming across the Great Lakes and down the eastern seaboard over here. They're concentrated down the Mississippi River, down through to the east of the Rocky Mountains, down through the central Great Plains area, down to coastal Texas, and then over here, okay, down the Pacific coastline. So these are called flyways, all right? These are called flyways. And the two that are in the eastern United States are called the Atlantic Flyway and the Mississippi Flyway. All right, and over half of the birds in North America, migrating waterfowl, end up coming down those two flyways. The other two are called the Central Flyway, which comes down through the Dakotas, down through Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, Playa Lake region in here, and then down here into coastal Texas. And then the Pacific Flyway over on the West Coast. All right. Now let's take a look, and this is my attempt here is to build the understanding and the justification for why the North American Waterfowl Management Plan was conceived. Okay? Now, this is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Canadian Wildlife Service have been collecting and estimating North American waterfowl population levels for 60 years almost. Okay, back in the 50s it started, and every year they come up with an estimate all the way to this year. Okay, they'll be in the process in about another month or two as the birds get back in the north and doing various types of surveys and counts up on the breeding grounds up in the prairie pothole regions of Canada and the central, north central United States. Now, first of all, when you look at that graph, all right, this is through 2000, I think it's through 2006 actually, just last year. What do you observe? Up and down, right? It's definitely, these populations are cycling for one reason or another. A lot of times we see it in wildlife populations. What about those troughs, okay? Okay, we see that this decline here in the 80s and also back in the late 50s, early 60s. Well, about this time, you know, in the 70s is when we really started to become more the science and just the interest, etc., was catching, starting to develop with respect to conservation. And we started to become aware and have a concern with decreasing numbers in any type of population, including waterfowl, which has always been in waterfowl hunting and waterfowl viewing has always been a very important part of American pastime. And they basically plummeted, the populations plummeted. First of all, if we just look at a benchmark on average, if we take all of these numbers and average them together, the long-term average of total waterfowl, total ducks, this is just ducks, this doesn't include the geese and the swans, okay, but total ducks is around 37 million. That's an important number because we'll come back to that in just a moment. And right around 37 million. And actually, let me just restate that. Those were the levels basically during the 70s, the average levels through the 70s. And those are considered basically benchmark levels. And we'll revisit that in just a second, because that's going to be a benchmark for us for the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. In 1985, waterfowl populations hit an all-time low in recent history. It actually dropped a little bit lower back here. But an all-time low in recent history, in the movement of what became kind of the conservation era that we're in, and that was alarming. 1 year later, professionals from the United States and Canada, and actually right here during this time as it was going down, they were planning, ended up getting together and releasing the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, which is a conservation plan that is focused on conserving waterfowl populations. Okay? It's an international plan that with the goal of conserving and maintaining waterfowl populations. And we'll provide a few more details on the next slide. Okay, the first thing that North American Waterfowl Management Plan did is it recognized that, well, if we're going to manage continental populations of waterfowl, we just can't do it altogether. We really need to focus on it in regions. And so the regions that they decided to go with corresponded directly with the natural flyways, okay, that we have, the four natural flyways. So they broke up states into jurisdictional regions and management regions. Okay, the Atlantic flyway, flyway, the Mississippi flyway, Central and Pacific. And you can see Tennessee is within the Mississippi flyway group, okay? And each of these ultimately they work towards the common goal of maintaining birds within their jurisdictional area to maintain the total continental population at a certain level. And again, we'll talk about that certain level as far as population size in just a moment. Okay, but they actually also pretty much operate independently. Regulations, hunting regulations, population estimates, hunting regulations, fall flight forecasts coming down, how many birds are going to come down, are all done independently. Okay? Any questions? The conception of it began in probably 84 to 85, and it was actually released in 86. There were, actually during this time you could use lead shot, yeah. You still could use lead shot. Steel shot regulations came into play, wow, golly, Dr. Bueller, what was it, late 80s?
No, actually I know in Wisconsin it started in kind of the early 80s.
Early 80s, yeah.
In some.
Mm-hmm.
So it was right during that same time.
Yeah. There is a substantial amount of literature out there that shows the negative impacts of using lead shot, and primarily lead poisoning associated with lead shot is associated with ingesting the lead shot. Remember, ducks are going through and they're sifting through a piece of lead shot, feels to them just like it's a seed, and they ingest it. So most of the lead poisoning occurrences are based on ingesting it as opposed to being shot and cripples. Okay, so but lead shot alone probably was not the reason for this decline. In fact, there are a lot of things that were going on through the 70s and, well, actually from the 50s through the 70s, and a lot of that was dealing with really the reduction of nesting habitat of waterfowl on the breeding ground. So up in this area, we have the prairie pothole region, and around most of those wetlands, there's a lot of agriculture going on. And so those wetlands are a lot deeper. They were carved out by glaciers compared to the Playa Lakes that we talked about, which are wind formed and much more shallow. So for the most part, outside of draining some of those prairie pothole areas, farmers were not going into those wetlands. However, all the nesting habitat that was around it, which is basically grassland, short grass prairie, that had been converted to agriculture. So that certainly is probably one of the reasons, a reduction in nesting habitat. And as you reduce the amount of nesting habitat, predators can forage more efficiently, you have an increase in predation rates, you have lead shot, a lot of these things. But the other very interesting thing, which you may remember when I had a slide up with the number of ponds that were last Friday, we were talking about the importance of wetlands for various types of wildlife. And on the top graph, we had number of ponds that were available up in the breeding grounds. Okay, and then we had number of waterfowl. And one very interesting thing is that when you have a wet year up in this area, okay, when you have very wet conditions and there's a lot of ponds that are flooded, you see waterfowl numbers increasing. Okay, so there's a lot of things here that could be resulting in the decline. One of those things also could be just lower. During this period of time, there was a lot less rain. It was during a period of drought, and there were fewer areas basically to raise ducklings. And so, anyways, for whatever the reason is, this was definitely a point of concern, and it at that time, it definitely was believed that that what was driving this was humans, period, okay? And I think now we have a little bit better understanding and feel that natural weather processes also are very important with respect to North American waterfowl populations fluctuating, okay? Okay, let's see here. All right. Any other questions? All right. Okay, so the North American Waterfowl Management Plan is a conservation plan, an international agreement among Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Initially, 1986, it was just Canada and the United States, and Mexico joined the group and the partnership in 1994. Okay? And again, the goal is to, actually, I think I have the goal right here. The strategy and the goal is to restore continental waterfowl populations to benchmark levels in the 1970s. Okay? So the goal is to basically have our waterfowl populations maintained at around 37 million, our duck populations. At around 37 million. And this is achieved through three different processes. One is protecting our wetlands, one is restoring wetlands that are degraded, and then the other is managing or enhancing the existing wetlands that we have. So those are three approaches that are outlined. Now you can imagine that attempting to implement a management plan, a conservation plan, I mean, it's challenging enough on your own WMA or even if you go to a larger scale within one region, for example, of TWRA, to implement these different management plans and get things rolling. Imagine doing it on an international scale, a continent scale. It's a pretty daunting task. And so that was recognized pretty early in the conception of the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. And so they implemented what are called joint ventures. And joint ventures, there's a unique joint venture for each color that you see on this map. All right, looks like about 15 or so joint ventures. And what joint ventures are, is they're a collection of government agencies and non-government organizations that have the vested interest in basically managing and conserving waterfowl populations. And they are organized based on areas that have been identified as unique ecological and conservation importance and concern. So within within Tennessee, we actually have two different joint ventures. The first, which is probably one of the most established joint ventures in the country, and also progressive joint ventures in the country, is the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture, which is this kind of greenish color here, okay? And you can see Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture extends from basically Louisiana up through western Mississippi, western Tennessee, portion of Kentucky, portion of Missouri, Arkansas, a little bit of Oklahoma, some of eastern Texas, and some of eastern Texas, this whole area right here. Okay? And then we also have the Central Hardwood Joint Venture, which was just recently established. At least it just recently got a coordinator. Mm-hmm. Sure. It's a collection of government and non-government organizations that have come together voluntarily to work towards the conservation and management of waterfowl populations. Now, since the conception of the waterfowl management plan and actually the joint ventures, there are other groups of species that are also included underneath of goals of different joint ventures. Okay? So the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture also has a very large shorebird initiative, as well as other types of migratory birds. And some organizations, for example, that are part of the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture are, for example, TWRA is. All the states that are involved, their state agencies are members. Fish and Wildlife Service, Nature Conservancy, Ducks Unlimited, and other organizations like that. Okay. Now, each of these joint ventures has specific goals, like this is what we're going to do with respect to protecting, restoring, enhancing, etc. And another thing that each of these these joint ventures do that are in the migrating and wintering areas is they calculate duck use days. Okay? Duck use days are calculated by the joint for a joint venture and ultimately go to the North American Waterfowl Management Plan Council to see do we have enough resources out there for our birds that are breeding up here and ultimately migrating and wintering in very small areas. Okay, so again, we have the two joint ventures in our state. So with respect to managing North American waterfowl populations and meeting this goal, we can really affect the goal by doing two different things. Number one are the quantity of habitat, obviously, that we have out there. And then the other is the quality of habitat, which y'all can directly influence through management. Okay, so we have the amount that's out there, and then we have the quality. And this is where we really can have a big influence, although certainly restoration has a part and conservation programs have a part with respect to the quantity. Really influence the quality. And that's where duck use days is a way just to evaluate that quality. Simple as that. Is that clear? All right. So what is this whole duck use day thing, right? It is a calculation that is used to try to estimate waterfowl foraging carrying capacity. As you know, carrying capacity in general, there are a lot of things that go into the carrying capacity of an organism. But it's been at least agreed upon that in the migrating and wintering areas, one of the most important things influencing carrying capacity for those birds is the amount of food resources that are available. Okay? Now, it's important to have other aspects too, which we'll really kind of talk about some more when we talk about green tree reservoir management, which is providing some areas where they can get away from the cold, they can get away from predators, where there can be areas where they can do courtship displays. Those are other aspects of carrying capacity and that are important for the survival and ultimately the reproduction of the various species. But it has been agreed upon that food in itself is one of the most limiting factors and important factors influencing carrying capacity of waterfowl migrating wintering waterfowl populations. Duck use days is just a calculation to try to get us there. All right? So what are ducks eating in the fall, in the winter? Okay. Yep, they're eating seeds, and in some aquatic inverts, okay? Now, with respect to seeds, why is that primarily the primary component in their diets? It's for energy, okay? So if we think about that, now these are food items, right? And they're eating them because they have energy, all right? So we can, before we even put up the formula for duck use days and talk about it, we can think about it in this context. We have food and we have energy. So couldn't we just actually figure out how much energy is out there in that wetland? And if we know that on average a duck spends X amount of energy per day to sustain itself, then we can think about how many ducks we can sustain in a wetland over a given amount of time, or in an agricultural area that has some waste grain, for example, or a food plot. Does that make sense? That is exactly the fundamental concept of duck use days. A word definition is right here. The number of waterfowl, and you can actually calculate goose or geese use days. We won't talk about that. We do that in advanced wetlands. And there are now shorebird use days. Okay? So we're just going to talk about duck use days. The number of waterfowl that can be sustained in a given area for a given amount of time. And that area is usually your management area. And so you're going to calculate duck use days for your different habitats that you have. Now this, you know, you may just have moist soil wetlands. You're going to calculate the energy there. Or you may have some food plots as well, or some upland areas with waste grain where you've done some sharecropping and there's some grain that's still out there in the field. And you may have some hardwood bottomland areas that do provide some food resources. You may have all three of these things. And you calculate duck use days, the amount there, independently for each of these. Okay? And then you add them all together, and that is your total duck use day for your area, which you report to your regional boss. Okay? Any questions with that? Seem pretty clear? All right. What is specifically a duck use day? One duck use day is equal to the quantity of food necessary to feed one duck for one day. Okay? That has really a logical, conceptual interpretation or meaning. The quantity of food necessary to feed one duck for one day. So if you had, let's say we calculate our duck use days, and you have 3,000 duck use days. That means you could sustain 3,000 ducks for one day. Is that clear? Now, usually we are not so much interested in one day, and often in East Tennessee, let me back up. We are interested in just sustaining ducks for one day, right? That's not a very good management practice. All right, there you go. There's the food resources, one day, and that's it. It's not reasonable because you're having birds coming throughout that migrating wintering season. Okay, and again, remember from yesterday, when is our migrating wintering season primarily within the state of Tennessee and going farther south? November through March, that's correct. And we do have some early migrants that are coming down in September. We may want to provide a few food resources for them, but primarily November through the beginning of March. And usually in March, they start to head back to the north. All right, so that's what we're thinking about. It's not just one day. What we want to do is sustain them for, you know, at least 3 months, at least December, January, and February. Those are the most critical. But usually when we think about managing in the south, we talk about going from about mid-November through February or so. In fact, often what is used is either, depending on when you expect birds, you either try to sustain birds and talk about sustaining birds for 90 days or 110 days. And actually, most common is 110 days. So that takes you basically from mid-November, for the most part, through February. All right, any questions with that? All right, let's see here. Go to Mississippi, you probably won't hear duck use days because there was just a paper published last fall by some folks out of UC Davis that said, you know, duck use days is an inappropriate term. We should be calling it duck energy days. Duck energy days, not use days. Because implicit or duck use days, use implies that your ducks are using it. That's not true. What we are calculating is potential energy carrying capacity. So it's really potentially what we could energetically sustain out there. And so more appropriately, it should be called duck energy days. And I agree with that. So, but the majority of folks that, as far as managers that you'll run into and biologists, they still call them duck use days, and they're not aware of that paper yet. So just so that you all are aware, soon you will start to hear more and more about duck energy days. It's identical. It's a change in terminology. And it's a good change. Okay? It's all based on energy. Good? So. Now, we can, again, as I mentioned before, what we're talking about doing is for each of these different habitat components. So for example, in cropland. Now we have two food resources, right? That waterfowl, that dabbling ducks at least, are primarily focusing on. Seeds for the most part in the fall and the winter, and they are picking up some aquatic invertebrates. And they need those aquatic inverts as we talked about yesterday. All right? There are molts that are going on in the fall, and there are still protein needs and demands. But for the most part, they're picking up seeds, and they're consuming seeds. So we're talking about these two food resources. So really, to come up with duck use days for a particular habitat type, we really need to calculate duck use days for each of these food resources. So for example, here's our seed and our inverts. Now, as a general practice, usually duck use days for inverts is just ignored. Okay? And there are a couple reasons for that. A, because this is considered the most important resource, and the most important resource and the largest contribution to duck use days, because this is what they're consuming. Secondly, actually, we're not here yet with respect to science. We really have had a chance, still, we'll talk about estimating duck use days for inverts, but for the most part, we really, invertebrate populations fluctuate so much, it's really a challenge to come up with good estimates of duck use days. But there are estimates, some estimates that are out there. Yeah, good question. Good question. So what about the breeding areas? Well, in general, duck use days are only calculated in the migrating and wintering areas. Now, they are very important, and inverts are very important in the breeding grounds for hens for egg production, for the ducklings, for growth, and also for molting, both for the adult males and the hens. Okay. However, in general, what is done in the breeding grounds is basically make sure you have water and you have a deeply flooded area where that produces aquatic inverts and that you have nesting cover. And so primarily breeding management in the north central United States and up into Canada, Midwestern areas, Wisconsin, Michigan, and northern Minnesota, where there's also some breeding, they focus on providing nesting habitat and brood rearing habitat. Okay, so there isn't any calculations made for energy. Okay, and again, there's the reality of it is that carrying capacity is much more complex on the breeding grounds. At least it's agreed upon. It's just not about energy. They need a lot of other things. And so far, they're a lot of other things outside of just eating. Okay, like providing good nesting cover. So, as of right now, there is no standard way to come up with how many birds we can support in a given area. We do know that on average, X number of duckling or X number of broods can be raised on a certain acreage of breeding habitat, and that a certain amount of nesting habitat is necessary per nesting female. So they can come up with some estimates, basically, of what they would expect to nest. But anyways, does that answer the question? Good. All right. So let's get to the nuts and bolts of duck use days. And Duck Use Days was conceived by Dr. Harold Prince at Michigan State University. He really didn't conceive it entirely in himself, because he basically borrowed the concept from the poultry physiology literature. But Dr. Prince was really the first to say, okay, this is how we can estimate potentially the number of waterfowl out there in migrating wintering areas. Incidentally, Dr. Prince was Dr. Kaminsky's major professor, and Dr. Kaminsky and Dr. Ken Reinecke are colleagues, and Chuck Lesh is one of Dr. Kaminsky's former students. So the concept of duck use days really came out of the Michigan State. But then now Dr. Rick Kaminsky, who you all will meet, is now at Mississippi State, and he's colleagues with Ken Reinecke, who is down in Jackson, Mississippi, works for USGS. Chuck Lesh works for the Mississippi Valley Joint Venture. Golly, what does Chuck do? Do you know Dr. Buehler? I'm trying to remember. Okay, anyways. Okay, so duck use days. Again, right, food, energy. That makes sense. All right, let's calculate the amount of energy we have out there. So that's what goes into the equation. On the left side, up in the numerator, you have food. And you can think of food as the amount of grams or the amount of kilograms that you have out there in a food resource. And it's considered, we do dry weight here because that's true physical weight, takes, you know, without water, okay? Which ties in more strongly to the energetic content. So we have a certain amount of food out there. Well, if we go out there and we get these food items, we can actually come into the lab and figure out how much energy they have in lab studies. So that's the other thing. Then we calculate, we have the amount of energy that food has per gram. TME stands for true metabolizable energy. TME, true metabolizable energy, and it is represented in the units kilocalories per gram of food. Okay? And TME estimates are available for a lot of different duck foods. And several of the handouts I gave you have TME estimates. One of those, which you'll see it's written on there, is Kaminsky et al., 2003. Okay, that's one of your handouts. We'll go through your handouts later when we actually do specific examples for calculating duck use days. All right, that differs, true metabolizable energy differs from what is called gross energy. One of your tables, the one that is by Anderson and Smith for inverts, has gross energy values. And that's important to recognize because gross energy is always going to be greater than true metabolizable energy. Gross energy is the total amount of energy in a particular in a gram of food. The total energy. True metabolizable energy, okay, gross energy, is the total energy in a gram of food. True metabolizable energy is the amount of energy in that food that can be metabolized by a particular duck species. So it is species specific. Gross energy is the total energy. True metabolizable energy is that the amount of energy that actually a duck can get out of the food. And certain ducks can get more energy out of a particular type of food than other ducks. So you see gross energy just provided without any reference to a particular species. You see true metabolizable energy provided and indicating which species it is referring to. It's done for particular species. It's species specific. So the bottom line here is this is the one you want to always use. Even though I'm forcing you all in one of the problems to use gross energy, because I want you to think about it. Okay, and reflect on it. And there's some thought questions with respect to thinking about gross energy and true metabolizable energy. Okay? All right. So the bottom line is that if we use gross energy here, our duck use day estimate will be inflated. It will be inaccurate. It will be more than what it should be. We should always use true metabolizable energy estimates. Any questions with that? Now we have the amount of energy that's out there, right? In a particular moist soil wetland, in a food plot, in a harvested cornfield, okay? We know how much is out there. Now, to figure out how many ducks we can sustain out there, we need to have a value for how much energy it takes for them to be sustain themselves for a particular day. That is called the daily energy requirement of waterfowl, or the daily energy requirement of a duck. So how much energy is necessary for a duck to sustain itself in a day? Daily energy requirement. Okay? Daily energy requirement. And it is represented with, in the units, kilocalories of energy spent per day. Kilocalories per day. And if we do the calculation here, multiply food, the amount of food, by the amount of energy, divide it by the daily energy requirement for ducks, we get what is called a duck use day, or an estimate of the number of ducks we can sustain in a given area for a given amount of time. We'll come up with total duck use days, and ultimately we will decide how many days do we want to sustain birds. Like, for example, I guess I erased it, 110 days. And we'll divide this estimate of duck use days by however long we want to sustain them, 110 days or 90 days, to figure out how many ducks we can sustain on a given day. Okay? We'll go through those calculations at the end. Any questions with that? Good. Okay. So, available food for water. Well, we'll talk about estimating this. This is the thing that we do. What do you do as a biologist? You go out and you estimate food availability. That's, you create food and then you estimate food. And that's how you calculate duck use days. Generally, constants are put in here for the true metabolizable energy and for the daily energy requirement of waterfowl. So we use published information about the amount of energy in a particular food item, okay? So we use some number here that's in the literature to multiply by the amount of food we have, and we use a number that's out there for daily energy requirement. The just for some of the natural foods, moist soil seeds, 2.5 kilocalories per gram is used most often. And for aquatic invertebrates, 3.5 kilocalories per gram. Now, there is, those are most often used, but we'll take a look at the handouts. The amount of energy in seed, in a gram of seed for a particular species of moist soil plant, it differs quite a bit. There's a lot more energy that can be acquired in some plants, from some, the seed of some plants, than from others. And also the amount of energy in a gram of invertebrate varies quite a bit among the different types of inverts that waterfowl may eat. But on average, if you average, these numbers are basically averages across a lot of different species of seed and a lot of different inverts. These are the numbers that are often used. Daily energy requirement, the number that is always used, for better or for worse, is 292 kilocalories per day. And that is for actually a female mallard. Mallards are often the duck that is used for daily energy requirement, and often the ones that are used for the true metabolizable energy content. Okay? Because these numbers do depend on, remember what I mentioned before, depend on the species. But often folks say, well, mallards are a good model, we'll use them, since we don't have the data available for every single species out there, at least yet. Yeah. Of whatever your area is. That is exactly the process of going through and doing a direct estimate. Oh, the thing that's really going to blow your mind is that is the most accurate way to do it. And if you have some type of sampling scheme where it's like a random sampling scheme, or you have even a transect that's going across your wetland, you're pretty much hitting areas, you're getting a pretty good estimate. Now, there are two other methods, and the most common method doesn't even require field reconnaissance. And so we'll talk about that. There are three methods to come up with this food availability number, and we'll talk about those in just a little bit. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say you have 192 days with 92 ducks per day that you can feed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you have, let's say, 150 mallards come in, well, what happens when you get 50 green wing tails, 50 blue wing tails, and then you get going?
That's right. That's a great point. The reason for using a mallard is because most of the physiology work that has been done on ducks has been done on mallards. And you will notice we do have in one of your problems there are some estimates for blue wing teal and mallards as well, and you calculate them for those three different birds. And you look to see, how does that affect my total duck these days? You know what? It doesn't affect it much. It really doesn't. Your estimates come out very, very similar. These birds are pretty much, on average, getting about the same amount of energy out of food. What there is less information on is the daily energy requirement for a particular species. And mallards are just used as the standard. And assume that, yeah, maybe blue-winged teal use more energy per day than a mallard does, but then maybe there are other species that use less energy, and on average, when we're thinking about this, with respect to the, because you never know what's going to come through anyways, you know, we use them as a model. Yeah. So is that about the same thing? Same thing. Okay, good. All right. Good questions. Any other questions?
Organism that would eat this if they're not there? Do you have to add in another type of bird or something else that eats the same thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. What about food depredation or granivory of these seeds prior to ducks getting here? We'll address that issue because a lot of the estimates that have been made for moist soil seeds and also, and especially for agricultural grains that are left out there, have been in, well, for moist soil seeds, most of them have been done right around plant senescence or in October, okay? For waste grain, many of the waste grain estimates that have been done out there have been done right after the combine goes through. Well, that could be September, and it's, you know, 2, 3, 4 months before birds get there. What happens to that seed? And our estimates for waste grain are really crappy, actually, and probably very unrealistic. So the bottom line is to really have a good feel for what's out there for the birds, at least when they start getting here. Your estimate should come from around November, okay? And yes, from there, it's going to decrease. You can expect it to decrease through either decomposition or granivory or some other thing by other species, even outside of waterfowl. But usually when you flood these things too, waterfowl are the primary things eating those food resources. They sometimes incidentally are picking them up, but yeah, you're right. But there are other things, you know, various types of migratory songbirds and things flying through and picking up and eating, you know, seeds off of the head of the plant. Once you flood them, though, pretty much waterfowl are flood those areas, water are using it. Out in grain fields, everything's eating it. You know, I mean, who knows? I mean, rodents, blackbirds, etc. Yeah.
How does we talked yesterday about the decomposition of seeds when they're in the water? How's that calculated?
It doesn't. This ignores decomposition. Yes, it does. It ignores decomposition. Now, for the most part, that isn't a big issue for moist soil seeds, because you remember they're decomposing very little. They're losing very much of their very little of their energy value. But for grain, that's a different thing, and we're just starting to get our hands around that. We'll talk about that. So, good questions. Yes, yeah, sir.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is this something that managers do? They're like, well, I've got this number that's shooting for and then walk off, or is that something that's actually gone back and checked throughout the season?
It's checked annually, but it's not checked throughout the season. And the bottom line is because, you know, usually by the time the birds are getting here, you're done with management. About all you can do is flood things up and or knock things down if you have maybe a cornfield or something like that. Your ability to influence management and the amount of energy they're having during the summer months, when you're doing your moist soil management or you're putting in food plots. So the estimates, well, we'll talk about estimating. If you're doing it in the fall, it should be done probably in November for your grain and for moist soil areas. We'll talk about that, and often that's not done, but anyways. Does that kind of clarify things? Okay. Oh. Yeah. Well, for the average biologist, they have a lot of things going on, and it's actually a challenge just to get folks to go out one time with, whether, you know, just with the various tasks they have going on and convincing them that they need to do it is one of the things I've run into is a challenge. Most folks don't do that. But anyways, we'll talk about that. It kind of gets into different techniques of calculating this available food. Hopefully by the time we get done, y'all are convinced of, you know, one or two ways to go out there and do it that you feel would provide a good estimate. Okay. So why estimate duck days? Again, before we get into the different methods, I want to bring this all into the context, into a framework that brings it back to the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, because this is just not a calculation that is done in academia and just for the sake of doing it. It has biological meaning. And all right, that's the next slide. So why do it? First of all, to see if there's, we've already mentioned this, if there's sufficient resources to support the existing population size of North American waterfowl that are migrating and wintering in the United States. Okay, that's the first reason. And again, the next slide, we're going to specifically talk about, well, are we meeting our goals? Are we meeting our, the North American Waterfowl Management Plan has a total duck use day goal, and it's broken down into the different flyways, which are then broken down into the different joint ventures. And they say, we need this amount of food resources out there. All right, are we meeting our goals? And the next slide elaborates more on that. So there are specific state and regional goals. The other thing that, now this is again part of a continental effort here. The other thing that duck use days does for you as a manager is it helps you learn about and evaluate your management practices. If you go out and disc, or you say, hey, you know, I'm going to run a fire through it, then disc, and I'm going to do that in this field, and in another field I'm going to just disc. And I want to figure out what is better. You know, what's working for my area? or maybe you're applying a certain herbicide or something like that. Some of those techniques we talked about yesterday for management. You can use duck use days and calculate duck use days in each of those areas and use it to evaluate your management practices. So this is another great habitat evaluation management technique for wetlands that ties in directly to ducks. All right. Is that clear? So we have continental type objectives here that are tied into the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. And then we have state and regional Then we can evaluate our management practices just for our own personal benefit. Okay? Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay. So to give an example here of the state and regional objectives, TWRA, their objective is to produce, across all their WMAs, produced 87.5 million duck use days total. That's the total agency's goal.
Per year.
Per year. Okay, as of last year. All right. So, and from there, they look to see our WMAs. Okay, we expect that, Camden WMA, Wildlife Management Area, is going to produce this much. And they actually calculate these DUDs to make sure they're meeting their goals. Yes, ma'am. Oh my goodness, there's got to be. Wow, that's a good one. A lot, over 100. I'm guessing. Yeah, over 100. I know there's like 50 just in West Tennessee. Yeah. Yeah, there's quite a few. Not every WMA has a biologist over it. They may be over several, and certainly all of them don't have wetland management areas. But yeah. That's for the whole state. Yeah, yeah. Well, this is something that's pretty wild here. Okay, that's 87 million for the whole state. For Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge, their goal is 13 million. So that's pretty cool. You know, I mean, it's just one refuge here is basically, I guess it's about a sixth or so of, or a seventh, basically, of the whole state. Not a sixth or a seventh.
But that's not counted in, though, right?
No, yeah, these are separate. The feds and the states are separate, exactly. Yeah, and yes, absolutely. So that's all the WMAs, and just one refuge, though, here actually is a good portion of just our whole, all of our WMAs together. I think that Tennessee National has the greatest, they're expected to produce number of duck use days of the West Tennessee refuges. And they really have a very aggressive program to do that. So what that means for 110 days, they're providing food resources for, on average, 121 ducks for a day. And that number means something, actually, because that is, on average, what Tennessee National has when you look at this 110-day season, or this 110-day period of concern, is around 121,000 ducks. At sometimes they'll be up near 200,000, and certainly at other times they're much less than that. Okay? So that's their goal.
Does these averages fluctuate?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the number of duck use days that they have to meet change based on the continental population. All right, let's make an example, show a little schematic here of how it works. Here we have our goals, North American Waterfowl Management Plan goals, which is basically reflected in the number of waterfowl that are out there. Again, our goal is to get waterfowl populations, or to maintain them at least, for ducks at least, at 37 million ducks. Okay? And we look at our existing population levels, and then that comes down ultimately to state duck use days. Each state is calculating duck use days, and that comes from figures from your federal refuges there, your WMAs, and private lands. Ducks Unlimited is primarily, they've taken the responsibility for estimating duck use days on private lands, on hunting clubs, in areas of in harvested crop fields where waterfowl may land and actually consume those grain resources. They take that responsibility on in most areas. So again, when we're talking about coming in here and calculating these duck use days for each of these areas, it comes down to estimating the two food resources, and again, seeds are primarily focused on. So the question is, ultimately, how do we obtain reliable estimates? And that's the reading portion of this lecture, is how do we know that this is good? Because you know what? This is what drives everything. We want to make sure we have good estimates. Okay? Your management drives how much is out there, but if you have a poor way of estimating it, then it may not reflect accurately how many birds you could potentially support. All this information is from the federal refuges and the WMAs. For the state of Tennessee, it goes to all the WMAs submit their information, their DUDs, to the state waterfowl biologist, who compiles that information, who then sends it to the Migratory Bird Office. Each of the refuges in a particular area send their estimates directly to the Migratory Bird Office. Okay? Migratory Bird Office in the state of Tennessee is over in Memphis. All right, then those go to the flyways to get a flyway total duck use day, and ultimately, hey, can we support these populations? And ideally, in the perfect world, this thing cycles back around. Okay, well, we need more duck use days, and then it filters back down through the states and through the refuges. And if we need to increase quality of habitat or more habitat, then those types of decisions can be made. So the bottom line is we need reliable estimates of food production in order to have reliable estimates of duck use days to make appropriate decisions on management. Oh, you guys tell me. And is it a drake or is it a hen? Yep. Oh, you don't need to. Look how dark it is. Yeah. Yeah. And you know that could only be maybe a hen mallard, but look at the nice, also the green bill. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. Yeah, fired. Well, that's a, you know, hopefully you can. I mean, your goal is to, as a manager, is to meet a certain amount of duck use days. And there is pressure. We'll talk about how can you influence your duck use days. I mean, how can you jump that number up? More food. And we'll find out that when it comes to energy value, food plots, grains have higher energy than most natural seeds and foods. So what some areas do is they plant a heck of a lot of grain. They're like, there we go. We met our DUDs. Woo, you know, and that's it. And the thing is we've already talked about, that is not a healthy thing to do for the bird. Okay, they can't sustain themselves on waste grain alone. They need natural foods. Okay? All right, so let's talk about the three methods and we'll take a 15-minute break. All right? There are three different methods to estimate food resources out there, whether it's aquatic inverts or whether it is seed or grain. The first is quote-unquote constants, using constants. This is using information that's in the published literature. Okay, just like we talked about using TME constants and daily energy requirement, constants. Folks also plug in constants for the amount of food out there. So on average, we expect this much food to be produced in an acre of moist soil habitat, okay? Or in an acre of corn or an acre of harvested corn, based on folks that have gone out, researchers that have gone out and estimated, gotten those estimates over a lot of different areas. So some folks just plug it directly in. They use constants, okay? So that's one method. Second is what Nathan was asking about or making a point, is a direct estimate. That means you go out there and you collect the seed or you collect the inverts and you get a direct estimate of how much food is there. That is the most accurate way to do it. And the third is a new approach, which is using prediction models, an equation. The bottom line is you go out here and to do this, we get our best estimate, but it is extremely laborious, and we'll go through the steps in doing this. It takes a lot of time, it takes specialized lab equipment. Nathan and Jonathan are both part of this right now in the wetlands lab, and you spend a lot of hours looking through samples. The average biologist, just they don't have the time or even the equipment or maybe the expertise to do that. Okay, models are basically an equation. Okay, we're gonna measure something else that is very strongly correlated with food production and something that's easy that the average biologist can do pretty quickly. And we're going to predict the amount of food out there, but we're still going to go in the field and we're going to collect that information. Okay? We're not going to collect the food resource, we're going to measure something else and use it to predict food resources. So that's the third approach. And we'll talk about how you do each of these and the advantages and disadvantages of doing each of those. Sound good? So let's take a 15-minute break and reconvene at 10:15.